Last Thursday, May 20th, the pines outside of the Mohawk territory of Ganasetake, where community members and allies have been maintaining a presence for the past couple of months, were host to a solidarity rally attended by Indigenous people and non-Indigenous allies from across Quebec and Ontario. Community members there have been standing guard against a possible multi-force police invasion, combined of SQ, RCMP, and Ganasetake police, one which has been a constant threat since Chief James Gabriel and his mercenary police force were chased out of the community this past January. Determined to protect the sovereignty and self-governance of their territory, community members have stationed themselves at the east and west checkpoints of Highway 344, the main access road through Ganasetake. During the rally held on May 20th, community members and their supporters spoke passionately about the struggle to defend the territory against the imposition of outside governance, including the state's puppet leaders, to counter the racist media spin on the criminalization of their people, and to stand up for a community's right to dignity and sovereignty. We will now hear a couple of those speeches, the first given by Sean Brandt, an Indigenous organizer who works with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and lives in Tayandinega.
The community gathered itself, and maybe because it knew the consequences of what would happen if these people were let in. But down on the west end, the community gathered itself, their forces gathered themselves, and the community took the initiative to go after them, attack them, and disperse their forces so that they never had a chance to fully be able to organize and come in and invade this community. It was the first time that I actually realized and saw a community, an organization that stood up and took the advantage on the attack, knowing that we were going to be attacked, and won the battle. Over 12 hours on Monday, we fought them, and we seized a police car, we seized police equipment, and sadly, but necessarily, we put a few of them in the hospital. And that's not anything that we take pride in, but it's the realization that this isn't just some piss-ass little protest that's going on the side of the road. This is about a community that's standing up and fighting for its lives, fighting for its sovereignty, and fighting for its integrity. And in that shed there where sometimes we huddle, those of us that are there at nights and stuff, on the wall there's a poster. And most people carry wallet-sized pictures of their kids, but I carry a poster. On this poster it says, "I am proud because my people before me stood up against the overwhelming odds so that I might have a chance to exist. They were successful as I am living proof. I pray to the Creator that the future generations will feel the same about us, because we will stand up, we will be successful, and they will be the living proof." That was given to us by a brother, Leonard Peltier, who's doing time for his involvement in AIM and shooting that took place in the 70s in Pine Ridge. And when you're down, you go into that shed and you look at the picture of four little kids on the wall and you see that quote and you realize that what we're standing for now is overwhelming. It's the Canadian government, the province of Quebec, it's Jimmy, it's his goons, and the odds seem overwhelming, but we've proven that they're not. We've shown them that the hearts and the integrity of the people in Ganasetake is so much a part of our lives that they can't even enter into this community. They would have to come to every house and go door to door and boot them in and kill half the people of Ganasetake before they could ever get a foothold in here. And they saw that on that Monday, because that Monday was a referendum on the governance, it was a referendum on the policing, and the majority of the community came out and stood those lines. That was the referendum, that's what the cops saw, and they knew that it wasn't a handful of protesters. They knew this was a community initiative, and it had to be respected. We will never, ever show them our backs. We'll take our beatings, we'll take our shootings, and we'll take it face on, and we'll take it looking at us. Not by turning our backs and running and hiding for another day or allowing another generation to take up the responsibility that was ours. And that, to me, has been something that I've been standing for. and proud and honored to be in this community and stand shoulder to shoulder, Mohawk with Mohawk. Sister and brothers, call me an outsider, Jimmy does. Any blood that gets shed in Gunasadage is the blood of my family. And it's the same blood here as in Tyendinaga, as in Grand River, as in Akwesasne Gunawage. It's all our blood, it's all our family. And we make a commitment to stand, and we'll stand to the end. This gathering was about bringing solidarity. They've been running so much shit in the mainstream media. They've been saying that there's been drug labs, cocaine labs, that we're here somehow standing in defense of that. And the only way to get the truth out to people was to actually bring the people here and allow people from Gunasadage to actually speak to those issues themselves. And the message that we're sending out to the government and to the cops is that it's not Gunasadage by itself. It's not the Mohawk Nation by itself. It's people that hold very simple, basic values of human dignity and respect, of housing, of food for our babies. These are the people that share the same values as us. They come 6 or 7 hours to say to the people of Gunasadage, we'll stand with you. And this is demonstration, a small demonstration of the solidarity that exists and the strength that the people of Gunasadage have.
Today's been 51 days since we've been protecting our community. 51 days our men, our women have been standing day and night to stop those goons from invading our territory, to stop those goons from trying to push Canada's agenda. Canada is behind this. Paul Martin, pressure has to be put on the Prime Minister of Canada because they allowed this. They allowed the money to be paid to these goons. They allowed Quebec. They are accountable. Since 1990, our lands have not been dealt with. Instead, Canada has put us under a police state with corrupt officers that think they are above the law. But Canada is not above the law. Paul Martin is not above the law. Paul Martin was the finance minister when these monies were released back in 1997, when they hired a known criminal, dressed him up in a Mohawk police uniform to go into a military base. Paul Martin was the finance minister. Jean Chrétien's appointee, Eric Meldoff, is the chief federal negotiator who is accountable for the $38 million that has been spent without 1 ounce of land being returned to the Mohawk people. I ask the people here today, put pressure on those federal ministers, those people in power that are dictating what is going to be decided and not allowing our people to have a voice here.
The recent conflict on this nearby Mohawk territory caught the attention of the wider public as recently as 3 months ago, when in January, the house of Grand Chief James Gabriel was torched and an outside police force was forcibly contained in the Gunasadage police station for over 24 hours. The community was responding to a secret deal with the federal government signed by James Gabriel to bring in an outside police force. A police force the community considered invasive and illegitimate, and one which was being instated at a cost of $900,000. In fact, the community's distrust for James Gabriel reaches much further back, culminating in his eventual ousting by the community by way of a non-confidence vote. Reinstated by the Canadian courts, Gabriel has continued to dismiss and overrule the wishes of the community, colluding with federal and provincial government authorities on issues of regional corporate development, the municipalization of the area, and Chrétien's now defunct First Nations Governance Act, the FNGA.
The issue of policing has been the locus of conflict in the latest struggle, and is a particularly meaningful one for this small, economically impoverished community. While mainstream media has continued to spin the story as one of organized crime and a community gripped by lawlessness, community members maintain that their people are being unjustly criminalized as part of a state agenda implemented by its puppet chief James Gabriel and his crew of outside police. It is an agenda that extends back to the territory dispute of 1990 and the Oka standoff over the development of a golf course on sacred land, and is one that is deeply rooted in the maintenance of colonial control over Aboriginal people, their land, and their resources. The community has been ardently challenging the ongoing criminalization of their members by both James Gabriel's police and the mainstream media, and the targeting of local people for the manufacturing and sale of native cigarettes. The people maintain their right to collectively decide to sell locally made goods and regard it as essential to the well-being of a community where opportunities for employment and economic well-being have proven elusive.
While Quebec Public Security Minister Jacques Chagnon has recently rejected James Gabriel's request for an additional $1.5 million to police Kanisatagi, a tiny community populated by just over 1,000 people, local chiefs estimate that Quebec is spending approximately $170,000 a day for 58 officers to police the area. There are also signs that the federal government has an interest in seeing things escalate rather than consenting to the wishes of the community. Community members, therefore, as well as members of the Mohawk Nation from outlying areas and non-Indigenous people from Quebec and Ontario and beyond, have been maintaining a presence in the Pines, outside of Kanisatagi, determined to stand against possible RCMP and government troops, who nearby Mohawk communities have been told to brace for by July. To explain in more detail about the struggle, we will now hear from a number of community members in interviews conducted over the past couple of months with CKUT Radio.
What brought us here to capsulate is the government's continual onslaught of interference, internal interference of a sovereign nation. The government has established the Department of Indian Affairs, which only has a fiduciary responsibility based upon the treaties that the government's made us take part of, thereby making them part of the white law, the treaties. The treaties and the fiduciary responsibility are a result from the lands that the governments took from the native people. And the monies that they get from the extraction of minerals and resources and such, the percentage of those monies come to the native people, not from taxpayers' dollars, but they come from lands that were taken from us. Now, the Department of Indian Affairs' responsibility is to ensure that the native people receive their portions of these monies. What they did was they created the department and its structure, where the money has to be filtered down, and it'll pay for the minister's daughter's ballerina dances and braces and therapy and whatever. And whatever's left after it's sifted down that structure, the pittance ends up on the territory. But that's not enough. Now they want the land. What little land was left, they want the land. Never mind, we're not even talking land claims. So their interference largely relies, the success of it relies on their ability to find an empty-headed imposter, such as James Gabriel, who, as they pull the strings and manipulate, will do their bidding in the guise as being considered a chief, which really he's not a chief. the council that was developed here, all they are is administrators for that funding. Now, this government, since 90 and before, have made attempts with various administrators or chiefs to get our land from us. Different ways. 90 is well documented. Now, since James was put into power, he didn't really waste any time. And everything he does is secret from the community, which goes against everything that an Aboriginal society is based upon, which is consensus and democracy. James and the government, or his handlers as we call them, formulated a plan. Now, they've consistently broken their own agreements with us, but there's no reprimand. There's no fallout. It's okay. But on our side, if we dare to question, they turn things on us, like with the media, the manipulation of the media, their PR firms. The side of the native people here is not heard, or it's twisted to accommodate what they want the people to think is actually being done here. The S24 agreement, where James wants us to harmonize with the very municipality that called the police and the army in to kill us. They had body bags stacked. They had 40 ambulances waiting on the outside to bring our bodies out. That was okay. That was a massacre. That was okay. Then they got James in there. James came cheap. He didn't ask too much because he wasn't sacrificing anything. They had the S24, which would strip us of our nationality, and we would become white. We would become citizens of Canada. Our lands. James had the power, as well as the government, to take our lands. If he felt he needed my property to put up toilets, he could do it. James is very efficient. He's been trained well. He was very raw when he got in the office and naive. But when you look at him now, they even taught him how to dress. He dresses like them. He knows the lingo. He's been coached very well. He's continually been found out. Several agreements and things that he's been doing with the government has been found out. And each and every time this community has tried to intervene, has tried to talk to James. First of all, we don't even get an audience with James. Last time I heard the community members attempted to talk to James, he called them, "You fucks." That's how he talks to his people. Well, we're not his people because he's half British. The guy's a sociopath. He's focused. He's got a means to his end, and he sees nothing else. He doesn't care who he steps on, who he hurts. He has no feelings for this community. He has no feelings or care for our future. His future has been cemented with the government. Now, whatever that payoff is, I don't know. But it has to be pretty good if this man is willing, in front of people he's grown up with, to treat us like we're dirt, we're dogs. Like I said, he's got a PR firm and handlers. All the monies that James is spending is coming from our community, which is in receivership, and it's just being piled onto our debt. And this is all at the hands of the government. Now, the internal interference of the government here, if you're looking at a source or the root cause of problems on Native communities, is the government. They get involved in us internally and make it look like we are dysfunctional, make it look like we are the violent ones. But we're not. We're reacting to a situation that's been created in a community. But the government wants to talk about organized crime. They are the ultimate epitome of organized crime because they create and break laws, their own laws. And who are you going to go to for recourse? The government is the ultimate. All right? They even control the police. They break their laws. They lie. They do all. So James is very, very comfortable. He's been nestled amongst the organized crime itself. He's covered. He has every resource given to him to achieve their goal in this Native community anyway. And they're starting with us because we're small. So The people here have had enough. We've had years and years and years and years of this. But now the atrocity of this man who's going to pull away my identity, the identity of my children, my grandchildren. No individual, no human being has that right to tell me who I am or what I'm going to be. Nobody has that right. But the government cannot afford the legitimacy of Native people, Five Nation people, Unkwahunwas. They cannot afford it anymore because we're getting strong. We're getting strong. Our people are educated. We have a government. We are a nation. We are a society. You know, they have too much to lose. They just have too much to lose because when the truth comes out, the theft, the lies, the backstab, all debauchery, the murders they've committed to with Native people, smallpox, all this, residential schools, everything they've tried, and we've survived. They're like cockroaches. The government is like a cockroach. It refuses to evolve, but will probably outlive us all. Okay? Now, the people here have been bad-jacketed. The techniques from CSIS, bad-jacketing. You pound it in the press, criminal element, organized crime, drug dealers, this and this and this, and it's sensitizing. The society on the outside, as well as the people in this community and other communities, that, oh my God, what's going on in my community? You know, it's like, what, do we ride around in choppers? I'm associated with the bikers, or I'm a drug addict. Our society versus the white society, crime, everything, it's all over the place. What makes us unique? The stats quote that Gunasadage, when you're looking at crime rate, 80% less than our surrounding, like municipalities, we have 80% less. But yet, the government and James will state, oh, God, you think this is a hole in a wall? You think we're harboring everybody here? This is Babel. And he can do whatever he wants. So they're all being paid off. But that's not acceptable here. That's not acceptable with our people and for our children. And the few people that do stand out, the reason they're making such a big spectacular with the policing and all this is because, yeah, we're playing into their hand by being out here tonight. They want to draw out all the people here who stand up and verbally and physically put it in their face what they're doing. So James can come in and his officers can target us all. They'll criminalize us. What will be left here are the sheep who he does control because the band council here is the main employer. People who were here in January, some of these people have lost their jobs. By the mere act of being here, those 2 days. So you can understand where survival versus support, survival comes first, and you can't blame those people. Why isn't the government being dragged to court for breaking their own laws? Not to mention, not even the treaties, their agreements, tripartite agreements. There are certain things in that tripartite agreement that this council never honored. The political aspect and the policing aspect are never to mingle. Council is never allowed to be involved or have a say in the policing. But yet, with Larry Ross and Isaac, James ran this police station. James called the shots on the actions that they took on certain homes in this community. And it was always people who opposed James. But the government overlooked it. The government totally overlooked it. There was nothing wrong. If we communicated with the government, they would just turn around and say the opposite in the press. The dissidents have refused to meet, even though we said, yeah, we'll meet. But we have two conditions. You're going to meet the people. You're going to meet the community. So they sent out to the press this morning. They refused to meet. But nobody questions them because it's the government. They're using James. Yes, James is an issue here. But when you get right down to it, you want to solve this problem? It's the government. The non-native society has to understand, because the government does it to you guys too. Just that it's so subtle you don't see it. It's the government's interference in native issues where they don't have a place. They don't have a voice. They have no business, because we have a government. We are our own people and we can run our own business. All they are the bank tellers. They're supposed to give us our money and shut the fuck up. So when you look at the problem here in Gunasadage, wherever, Barrier Lake, governmental interference. They created it. They manage it from the outside. And we suffer for it.
I've spent months and months and years researching these so-called deals and documents that James Gabriel and the other so-called chiefs have committed and signed behind closed doors. And I want to make something perfectly clear. The two things. First, this deal that they've signed, they had no business signing. What the public has to realize is that they're not even chiefs in this territory. They are only chiefs by the fact that the Canadian government instilled them there. They have no authority here whatsoever. So any deal that they sign, how could we as a people recognize that? Now, to a couple other things, there's a lot of things, but one of the things that I want to make note of is our police force. Tracy Cross, a good police officer. We have our own police force. And one of the things I'm having a difficult time understanding is that they say that there is so much organized crime and so much all of this stuff here, and we even have that from their so-called organized crime expert. Now, according to the tripartite deal that was in place at that time, that then they were supposed to have shared that information with our police services so that our police services then could act, but they did not. You know, this is nothing more than a political jargoning so that they can come up here and James Gabriel can be claimed king of Gunasadage forever and, you know, make all the decisions in regards to the power base, well, what they call a power base here in this territory, i.e. the police station and the band council. I mean, you can look at social services, you can look at education, and those people have no power there. But the power base here in this reserve, our territory, is the band council and the police force. James is not willing to work with anyone. He sees only what he wants and doesn't give a damn about anything else. You know, but you can be sure. I mean, look, in 1994, the reporter got the documents from the Secret Access to Secrets Act. They had plans of invading Mohawk territory all the way from Gunasadage all the way down to Agwesasne back in 94 with over 20,000 troops. And that's an official plan that we got from their own documents, you know, and that was in 94. And they have not stopped, okay? Now what they're doing, because they said they had to call that off because it was too risky, right? So now what they do is they take small groups of 200 cops, 200 crooked cops, and then they, you know, promote their will. And see, that way it's not a great big deal, right? That way they don't have to deal with so much of the political fallout. Now all I'm saying here now is James Gabriel, Clarence Simon, Maurice Chenier, and Doreen Gunadongwe, they're not recognized as chiefs here. You know, we've always been willing to negotiate, but not with James Gabriel, not with Clarence Simon, not with Gunadongwe or that other person, Maurice Chenier, okay? Because we don't recognize them as chiefs. Yeah. I'll tell you what we do recognize them as, and this is in the legal definition. They are traitors to our nation. Look up the definition, folks. You see the definition of what traitor is, high treason. And they have committed high treason to our nation. So I ask you, where else in any part in this country, let's say in Canada, where, let's say, the mayor would have the right to hire and fire the police chief, the police commissioners, and the police force? How come the Canadian government is so freaking willing to come here and change that for us? But yet, if they tried to pull this crap out in any other city or town in this country, they couldn't do that because the law says they can't. They don't have that. The political body has got to remain separate from the police commissioners. And that's in every city and province and community in this country. Yeah. But all of a sudden here in Gunasadage, it's not like that. Now they're trying to put this new apartheid agreement in that they signed, they had no business signing, and they never brought it forth to the people. And our process is that must be brought before the people, to the people. Now, we invited them to come and meet with the people. Yeah. And they sent back that letter to the news media saying today, well, the chiefs couldn't make it and stuff, and they wanted us to come and meet with unspecified people, which we found not a security threat. Yeah. You know, quite frankly, it wasn't unspecified. They knew very well that they were to come up here and meet with the people. That's our process. If James Gabriel's plan is so good, let him stand up before the people and lay it out before them and let them decide. That's his job. His job is not to be dictator of Gunasadage or anywhere else. His job is to work for his people, not against them. Now, I'll tell you straight, me, I'm a family man, never been arrested in my life. But I'll stand here and I'll get arrested today because I'll stand here from people here that I love and care about.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'll stand up for what's really right. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know, like I said, I mentioned before, if they have all this information, if they say they're doing all this because of organized crime, then why didn't they share that information according to the law with our police,
yeah,
with Tracy Cross, and the police commissioners here? They don't have that information because it doesn't exist. Again, it's just another concentrated effort since 1990s. Well, actually, since 1890s. No, hold on, since 1690s. You don't hold on, since 1490s. It's the same thing. And I don't want to rehash that old history, but yeah, today, in today's world, you know, this is a concentrated conspiracy to usurp every power base on this territory so that King Gabriel can be king for life. And I'll tell you, I got one last thing to say. It don't matter if there's only a few people here. This won't fly. Mm-hmm. It won't fly. It won't fly. It just won't. And it wouldn't fly anywhere else in this country. And you know what? This is a plea for Canadian people.
Yeah.
I'm a family man. Got a wife and children. Never been arrested in my life. I stood up for lots of good things. And you know, just once, I'd like to see the Canadian people show some empathy. We're not looking for sympathy or even anything other than empathy. Please, call your MPs. Call the so-called security minister, Anne McClellan. Look, what qualifies her? Really? If you were going for a job interview, people would want to know what your qualifications are. She may be a politician, but what qualifies her to run that department? Mm-hmm. Where's her qualifications for justice?
Yeah.
Security. She don't have no qualifications for that. And yet she's writing letters to us that are so insulting. Well, this is the result. Now call her. Ask her. Write to her, email her.
Yeah.
And Shania, the Minister of Indian Affairs here in Quebec. Because those two could pick up a phone and stop this right now. But they don't. They don't want to. Because they found their little man in Gabriel to do their dirty work for them. Instead of sending in 20,000 troops like they planned in 94. And I tell everybody, you go ahead, check those documents out. And if people are too afraid to look at their government and realize that they're just too damn brutal, well, then they'll be next too.
Ghana Sitake and the current community's battle against a possible multi-police force invasion combined of SQ, RCMP, and Ghana Sitake police has sent ripples through Indigenous communities throughout Canada as a current symbol of the Indigenous fight for self-determination. Indigenous people in Canada are around 4.4% of the population, according to Statistics Canada's 2001 census. To a large extent, their lives are still controlled by the Indian Act. This act, though it has been amended, was designed to be, and still remains, an instrument for trying to get Indigenous people to relinquish their land rights, their culture, and their languages. Its first incarnation was passed by the British House of Commons in 1857, its second by the Dominion of Canada in 1876. The 1876 version made it illegal for an Indian to sell or produce goods, or even to leave a reservation, without written permission from an Indian agent. Amendments over the following years include forbidding the Indigenous from practicing rituals and authorizing the forced removal of children to residential schools, centers where all kinds of systematic abuses occurred. These sorts of laws, particularly the law forbidding Indians to leave reserves without written permission, called the PASS system, were of interest to the South African apartheid regime, which modeled its system on Canada.
Given this history of colonization, defined through laws and legislations written and enforced by the Canadian state, the current community-based struggle in Ghana Sitake has inspired Indigenous communities throughout the world. There is growing support for the struggle of Ghana Sitake as groups and organizations from various cities have been traveling to the area to stand in solidarity with the community. Specifically, people are beginning to define the ongoing battle in Ghana Sitake as a current face of the ongoing Indigenous struggle against colonialism. We will now hear from Clifton Nicholas, who is a Ghana Sitake community organizer.
Well, basically, as it stands, for the past week, the police station has been completely closed off. The entrances into the police station have been blocked off with cement barriers. And there are people who are watching the entrance points into the community. What has been happening since April 1st is that there's been continual attempts almost on a daily basis, and usually in the evening or early mornings by these police that James Gabriel has assembled. There's about 60 officers presently around the locality of Ghana Sitake and Oka, and they try to come in by either entrance point in a community, and they're usually blocked out. When they do come through the community, they usually come through at like high rates of speed, driving, you know, recklessly through the community. So this is a continual thing, and it's like a sort of incitement towards soliciting some sort of a violent response from community members.
Now, it has been made very clear that there are 24 people and potentially over 100 people that do have to appear in court. There's charges which have been laid, although there's not a lot of information on all of the cases, as I understand. But maybe can you talk about these criminal charges which are pending for a lot of members of the community who have been standing up against what many people call the corruption of James Gabriel?
Yeah, there's 24 people who are being charged with the following. They're being charged with, one, participating in a riot, and a second charge is forcible confinement of police officers. And, I mean, the charges are ridiculous. For one, you know, people were telling the police to leave. Nobody was being forcibly confined, and nobody started a riot. There was no riot. Basically, it's ridiculous also the types of people they're charging. There's one woman who's like 65 years old who just basically went there and told them to leave, you know, for the love of peace, leave. She got charged with participating in riot and forcible confinement of police officers. So, I mean, it's basically a politically motivated charging of these people using the court for a political tool, and it has no support in the community. The community supporter is behind the 24 people who are being charged.
Let's look into some of the rhetoric which is being used by James Gabriel and also provincial and federal authorities. One thing which has been said repeatedly is that they want to have a peaceful resolution of the situation. They want to move forward and get past this crisis. But maybe can you give your perspectives as to this so-called yearning for peace on the behalf of the provincial federal government and also James Gabriel?
Well, they keep using the same hook and line when they're talking with the media and with the public. You know, they keep saying, well, we want a peaceful resolution, yet they refused mediation on four different occasions. Assembly of First Nations approached them at the behest of some community members over here to find a negotiated settlement to this, and four times they were refused. There were requests on the part of the three council members who remained in the community to meet with James Gabriel. And he didn't even respond. Instead, he sent his police into the community again. So this is the type of responses we've been getting. The similar rhetoric that's been going through the media is that we're all criminals over here, and that it's like the entire criminal element has been controlling the community. Since April 1st, there has not been one police officer in this community patrolling or having any position in this community, and there has not been any problems in this community. It's been quiet, except for them when they try to come in here and to incite violence. So the question is, are these police the root of the problem, or are they a solution to the problem? In the community's opinion, they're the root of the problem.
Well, maybe let's expand on how you see the efforts to implement this new policing agreement and police force in regards to continued history of colonialism or genocide against indigenous people. Obviously, as you have explained, there is a large opposition to the implementation of this new police force. Also, there is a large opposition in the community to James Gabriel maintaining his position. But maybe could you put this in more of a context in regards to indigenous history and also the current struggles of indigenous people?
Well, they've always used the whole idea of indigenous policing as a tactic to control native communities. If you go back into the early 1900s when they assassinated Sitting Bull, again, it was the so-called indigenous police, the BIA police, that killed him. The same with Geronimo. It was, again, indigenous police who brought him down, brought him into justice. You know, they're always using these collaborators to do their dirty work. And the same is true over here in Ganasadage and other communities. You know, they use this whole idea of community policing and using indigenous police as their tool to do this community policing. And most of the time, it doesn't function properly. It adds a divide in the community, especially when you're talking about Ganyankahaga communities, Mohawk communities. We have sovereignty. You know, we have our national government, you know, the traditional government. Then you have the imposed band council system. And these police fall underneath the band council system. This is part of the Indian Affairs Department. This is all part of that colonial mechanism. You know, you have a police force in the community that can keep tabs on militancy and weed out the militants, and crack down on any attempts at economic development, any attempts of putting up a front in opposition to developments and so on. Right away they become criminalized, and these police officers fall underneath the criminal code of Canada, and they fall underneath these different laws and have to apply Canadian laws on Indigenous people all the time. So that's where the discord starts, right there.
Now, maybe could you speak about why you feel both the provincial and federal government have been putting so much time, money, energy into implementing this new policing agreement and also this police force, and also in the larger picture, supporting James Gabriel. Why do they focus so much energy and time and resources on the community of Kanasatagi?
I wish I had a solid answer for you for that, but I mean, I'm going to get you some of what I've been thinking and what community members have been thinking. First, I just want to explain like how much money is being spent over here first. For the January 12th, 13th, and 14th, there was an allotment of $900,000. Since April 1st, there has been an allotment from the federal government of four equal payments of $1.3 million each to prop up this police force. As of last week, James Gabriel and that police force got $22,000 to set up a mobile command unit. As of yesterday, he got another $1 million for his police force. This is part of like what's going on in light of that. Somebody's making money. So that's the bottom line, is that it's profiting someone. But people in the community look at it in a couple of different ways. One is that they want to implement this bill called Bill S-24, which is a municipalization bill that they're trying to pass for Kanasatagi to become municipalized with Oka, within Oka. Basically, to do that, you have to be able to control the population and be able to pass legislation with leaders like James Gabriel to pass this legislation, which erodes any land claim that anybody has in this community. It erodes their title to land. It introduces the fee simple property rights. So this is what people are seeing as the route to needing these police officers to quell the community and to marginalize them further.
There has been a very strong history of Indigenous resistance in the community of Kanasatagi and more largely in the Mohawk communities. Maybe could you comment on if you feel that all this, as we spoke about, time, money, energy that is being spent in regards to a new police force has a relationship to, let's say, a fear or a political will on behalf of the provincial and federal government to silence this history of dissent?
Well, yeah, there's like the whole fear of 1990 within Quebec society, within Quebec government especially. Well, I should say segments of Quebec society, because some people were really like supporting what was going on with us, you know, doing what we were doing. There is a fear, and there's also a little bit of vengeance on the federal and provincial government's mind. If you look again, going back to these 24 people who are being charged, the Crown prosecutor that's being chosen to handle this case is François Brier. And he was the same prosecutor that handled the case against Lasagna, Ronald Cross, and Gordon Lazor Noriega during 1991. He was also the one who was pushing for the charges to be pressed in 1990. And he lost a lot of cases against us. So a lot of people are saying, well, why do you have this guy on this case again? He obviously has a vendetta. And it seems like the government's saying, well, it's all right. You know, you can let this man be the Crown prosecutor. And also, like, the whole 1990 thing, Kanasatagi has yet to be punished for that. And I think they're starting the punishment process since the past 5 years, you know, to continually doing things to subvert the community's will. This is part of what they're doing in connection with 1990. Also, like I said, they're using Indigenous police to do their dirty work. So now it doesn't look like as if the federal government or the Quebec Provincial Police are doing it for them. They say, well, it's an internal dispute. It's only these police, you know, community police, Indigenous police that are having a problem with criminals in the community. But you have to look at who's funding these police and why are they there and why are these numbers existing in these communities, numbers of police. I mean, you know, there's been word coming out of Ottawa that they have 100 men ready for a new national Aboriginal police force, okay, which is like a tactical team type thing that can travel from community to community wherever it's needed. And in Kanasatagi, there's about 750 people. On January 12th, they brought in 60 officers. It's very much overkill. I mean, the amount of equipment they had in that police station was about maybe enough ammunition for four bullets for every community member. So, I mean, you have to start asking questions. Why is there overkill with all this equipment? Why is there overkill with all this funding? It seems like the Canadian public and the media is not asking these questions.
Often, as you pointed towards, this situation at Kanesetagi is looked at in isolation. Maybe can you explain for people your perspective as to how you feel this current situation relates to an ongoing colonization or genocide against indigenous people? You yourself are a very strong indigenous sovereigntist. You have fought for the liberation of indigenous people on Turtle Island. So maybe could you give your perspectives on this?
Well, basically, as I see it, it's a step toward the final step towards assimilation. Okay, like with the so-called leaders in Band Council who signed these deals without the consent of the community, without any input from the community, all it does is it destroys the fabric of the community, the ability for the community to put up a united front. The introduction of these Band Councils is a large part of the problem that exists in Native communities across the board, because these people have no concern for the community. You know, all they're concerned about is their own profit and their own self-elevation inside the political hierarchy, you know, getting all the way up to the AFN or even the Department of Indian Affairs. This is the system they've created. As I see it, it's just a further method to destroy communities and to complete the process of colonization.
Why do you feel that what is currently taking place in Kanesetagi, the efforts to install a largely unpopular and unwanted police force in the community, largely by the will of outside powers, namely provincial, federal authorities, and Grand Chief, which the majority of the community has openly rejected, James Gabriel. Why do you feel that what is taking place currently in your community should be of direct concern for people in the greater Montreal area and throughout Canada?
Well, I'll start with the indigenous communities first. Kanesetagi is a doorway, okay? The way people feel in Kanesetagi is that They're trying to set a precedent with what's happening in Kanesetagi. They're trying to set a precedent, firstly, with native policing, secondly, with indigenous governance, and thirdly, they're trying to create a municipality out of Kanesetagi to start this process of municipalization throughout the other indigenous communities. Basically, there's been plans on the books since 1969 with Jean Chrétien's white paper to assimilate the entire indigenous population, eliminate collectively all their rights, eliminate the land claims and so on, and everything that goes with it. So Kanesetagi is a doorway to it. The second thing that I'm looking at, as far as a larger picture, as far as non-natives and natives are concerned, people in Canada in general, they're exercising this discourse of power and control in Kanesetagi. They're establishing a police state in Kanesetagi. They're attempting to do something in Kanesetagi to provide an example to other police forces. This is how you deal with this stubborn population. And you do it effectively in cities to some extent, but the way it's going now, these police that are roaming around here answer to no one. So this is the type of police force they're trying to create once again. We had this in 1990 with the Sûreté de Québec. They were a police force and they were a power unto themselves. They had no overseers, nothing. They did what they want. They made political policy, and this is the same thing that's occurring here in Kanesetagi. So it's a danger. The danger as far as civil liberties and rights of individuals is concerned. You know, what happens here, it's a microcosm of what can happen on a larger scale within Canada.
The solidarity rally held in Kanesetagi on May 20th reflects growing support for the struggle of this Mohawk community. The rally acted as a call-out for people from outside the area to get involved in supporting the Indigenous community in their fight for sovereignty and dignity. We will now hear from Abdel Tekriti, a Palestinian organizer from Toronto, who spoke at the rally and makes the links between the struggle at Kanesetagi and the struggle in Palestine. As explained, he sees a direct connection between these battles against colonialism.
Being here on three various occasions, I can definitely say that I've never seen a community so generous, so open to people from outside, so welcoming, and so powerfully rooted, so strongly committed to defending itself against incursions that are occurring at a grand scale. Against all odds, it stood against people who were trying to invade it. And this is something that's very uplifting. I have a special feeling when I come here, and I think that being a Palestinian contributes to this. The dynamics that we've witnessed here and that I've seen here are very similar to what's happening in a lot of places in the world right now. These are the dynamics of colonialism, dynamics of states that are powerful, that are settler states, that come and try to grab land, interfere in indigenous sovereignty issues, interfere with communities' processes of governing themselves, and that try to subjugate these communities. And we see this on a global scale. And this community has fought back. It has proven that these dynamics could be resisted. And through this process, it has uplifted me and a lot of other people that have witnessed its defense of itself. Colonialism must be pushed back. And it's fought on a micro scale, really. It's fought on the scale of everyday life through people's refusal to accept their rights being trampled on. That's resistance. That's the face of resistance that's against all odds.
We will now hear from Sue Collis, who is a community organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, who works and lives in Tyendinaga and has been active in supporting the community of Kanasatagi in their resistance to the efforts of James Gabriel, the provincial and federal authorities, to instate an unwanted police force.
I find myself always in a funny position in these things because I see them both from the inside and from the out. And I think that there's tremendous lessons to be learnt and actions to be taken as a result of that. A number of things have struck me already in terms of what people have already said. When John is talking about how maligned and lied about and twisted this community, the people in this community, and I think beyond the whole of the Mohawk Nation has been in the media for the whole duration of this fight. I think that we can easily get lost in that and place more importance maybe than we realize that we should be. And I think that's because, despite the fact that what has been said here today, the true words that have been said here today, aren't going to be in the Gazette tomorrow morning, they're not likely going to be on CBC Radio tonight, that doesn't take away from their truth, nor does it take away from the fact that the state, the Quebec government, the Canadian state, the SQ, the RCMP, and the military are all going to be aware of what was said, and that all of you are here to stand with the Mohawks of Gunnisadage and the Mohawk Nation, and we cannot underestimate that. There is no room within this battle to underestimate that. And I think that for people on the outside, non-Mohawk, non-Native even, that there comes to these kinds of things, inhibitions and confusion and a question of where their position or their place should be. And I think Abid really summed that up and said it well when he said how open and welcoming this community has been. There's a reason for that. When people, as Pearl said, has been on the line for 51 days and someone comes to stand up beside you, you're not going to say no. You're not going to say go away. You are going to say thank you. You're going to say, you know, we understand that we're all part of the same fight, and if people are willing to stand up and to join the struggle, that is the essence of what solidarity is. Solidarity, by its very definition, means shouldering some of the burden of the struggle, some of the burden of what people are living through day in and day out. And I know that that is present here today. I know, for instance, that there are people who put their jobs on the line just to be here and stand in the pines today. And that is meaningful, and that's important. And that's the message that I know the Canadian state will be taking back. And when they're considering whether they're going to send in 1,000 RCMP or move on next to Akwesasne and Ngunnawage or Tyendinaga, that knowing that the Mohawk Nation, that the communities and the people in them do not stand alone, and the people do not hesitate to stand with them, has an impact. So if there's anything that people bring back to their own communities and to their own organizations, that should be it.
The current community-based struggle in Gunnisataki has inspired Indigenous communities throughout the world. there is a growing support for the struggle of the community members of Ganasetaki, as demonstrated by the number of individuals and organizations from various cities and communities who have been traveling to Ganasetaki to stand in solidarity with community members. While mainstream media has continued to spin the story as one of organized crime and a community gripped by lawlessness, community members maintain that their people are being unjustly criminalized as part of a state agenda, implemented by the state's puppet chief, James Gabriel, and his crew of outside police. To get more information about the current situation in Ganasetaki or to get involved with support work, contact ganasetaki_indymedia@simpatico.ca. That's KANEHSATAKE_INDYMEDIA at simpatico.ca or visit www.ocap.ca. This story has been recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Brett Story, Stefan Christophe, and Julia Ford.